Hi, this is Jane Curtin. I love selected shorts. In fact, I'm always wondering why they don't ask me to read more. I mean, really, why is John Lithgow getting so much airtime? Have you heard my reading of Murakami's Iceman? Genius. Anyhow, when the folks at Shorts asked me to thank their podcast sponsor, Zabar's, I jumped at the chance. Zabar's and Zabar's.com sell over 8,000 pounds of freshly roasted coffee each week, and also have New York toasting bagels, smoked salmon, caviar, and babka. And Zabar's delivers throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. Listeners can find out about exclusive offers and free shipping and get a free story download at zabars.com/shorts. Hey, that was pretty good. Did you hear the subtle emotion I worked into that? Brilliant. Take that, Lithgow!
Could you go forward forever with your dogs at your side? What if he just kept going? Across the city, over the bridge, walking perfectly until darkness fell over the country. Sometimes he wished he could gather all the dogs he loved most and walk off the end of the world with them.
This week on Selected Shorts, No Bad Dogs, and Rick Moody tweets for love.
He said, the shoes are sublime. The shoes recall a semiotics of freight train hopping. And yes, the pins connect us to American folklore.
She said, the shoes are funky, and they make me want to dance on one of those light-up dance floor video game things.
I'm Parker Posey, and you're listening to Selected Shorts from PRI, the program that brings you great short fiction, read live on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. We like books, the old-fashioned kind, with covers and spines and pages that you turn yourself. But we also know that these days you can find good stories in many different forms. So it seemed natural to partner with the online publishing company Electric Literature, which offers digital versions of stories on their site. This program features two of them. First, Lydia Millett's Sir Henry, from her collection, Love in Infant Monkeys. All the stories in this book pair animals with celebrities. In this case, a very dignified Dotson and that Baywatch guy. Here's the read by award-winning actor John Lithgow.
The dog was serious. Always had been. No room for levity. Those around him might be lighthearted. Often they laughed, sometimes even at his expense. The miniature size, bouncing gait, floppy ears, he was a dachshund. It's not his fault, you were what you were. He would have preferred the aspect of an Alsatian, possibly a Norwegian elkhound. He viewed himself as one of these large and elegant breeds. This much could be seen with the naked eye, and the dog walker saw it. The dog walker was also serious, a loner, except for dogs. He prided himself on his work. He had no patience for moonlighters, for the giddy girls talking on their cell phones as they tottered through Sheep Meadow with seven different size purebreds on as many leashes, jerking them this way and that, and then screeching in indignation when the dogs became confused. He had once seen such a girl get two fingers ripped off. He called 911 himself. It was an ugly scene. The paramedics recovered the fingers, snarled up in leather and nylon. But the hand had been twisted so roughly they predicted it would never work right. The girl herself had passed out long before the ambulance got there. Turned out she was pre-med at Columbia. Two of the dogs were also injured. Their mutual aggression had caused the accident in the first place. He had seen it coming all the way from the carousel. The dogs straining and nipping at each other, the girl on her phone with the leashes tangled round her left hand. Himself, he was a professional with exacting standards. He made an excellent living. He had subcontractors, yes, but all of them were vet techs, trainers, or groomers at the very least. None were college girls who took the job literally, expecting it to be a simple walk in the park. The dog walker gave his charges respect as he saw fit. Some did not deserve it, and they did not receive it. To these frivolous or problem dogs, he gave only the curt nod of discipline. His favorite dogs had a sense of dignity. Theirs was a mutual approbation. Sir Henry was one of these. The owner traveled constantly, often in Europe, Asia, or South America, all over. He was a performer of some kind, in show business. When he was in town, he spent most of his time at the gym, maintaining his physique, tanning, shopping, or seeking photo opportunities. The dog walker barely registered him. The dog walker went to get Sir Henry 3 times a day, rain or shine. Henry seldom went out otherwise. The odd trip with one of the girls when they were home from school, or the wife on the rare occasion when she was not, like the entertainer, at the gym or shopping. Now and then, if he found himself at loose ends for 20 minutes or so, the entertainer paraded with Sir Henry personally, scoping the park for other celebs to do the meet and greet with. In the puppy days, he had taken Sir Henry out frequently, but the puppy days passed. There was an older dachshund, Precious, also owned by the entertainer, but Precious had been virtually adopted by one of the domestics, an illegal from Haiti, if the dog walker was not mistaken. The Haitian took Precious out on her cigarette breaks, but not Sir Henry. The dog walker walked Sir Henry alone, or with one particular other dog, a small poodle belonging to a dying violinist. The poodle was stately, subtle, and like the dachshund, possessed of a poise that elevated it beyond its miniature stature. The two seemed to have an understanding. The poodle marked first with great discretion. The dachshund marked second. They trotted happily beside each other at an identical pace, despite the fact that the poodle's legs were almost twice as long. They listened to the dog walker acutely and responded promptly to his commands. It was their pleasure to serve. Did they serve him? No, and he would not have it so. They served decorum, the order of things. At times, the dog walker enjoyed resting with them. He would settle down on a park bench, and the dogs would sit at his feet, paws together neatly, looking forward with an appearance of vigilance, their heads turned in unison as other dogs passed. When it was morning, noon, and night, of course, as it was with Sir Henry, it was no longer merely walking. The dog walker was in loco parentis. It was he who had discovered the bladder infection, the flea eggs. It was he who recommended a vet, a diet, a routine. In the economy of dog walkers, he was top tier. Only the exceptionally wealthy could afford him, those who did not even notice that their dog walking fees exceeded rents in Brooklyn. His personal service included a commitment of the heart, for which the mega-rich were willing to pay through the nose. About his special charges, he was not workmanlike in the least. He was professional, operating from a mature code with set rules for all of his employees. But he was not slick. He did not cultivate in himself the distancing practiced by pediatric oncologists and emergency room surgeons. His clients sensed this, and where their pets were concerned, his fond touch soothed the conscience. He began with respect and often ended with love. When a dog was taken from him, a move, a change of fortune, or in one painful case, a spontaneous gifting. He felt it deeply. His concern for a lost dog, as he thought of them, would keep him up for many nights after one of these incidents. When a young Weimaraner was lost to him with not even a chance for goodbye, he remained deeply angry for weeks. The owner, a teenage heiress often featured in the local tabloids, had given his charge away on the spur of the moment to a Senegalese dancer she met at a restaurant. He had no doubt that drug use was involved. The dog, a timid, damaged animal of great gentleness and forbearance, was on a plane to Africa by the time he found out about it the next day. The loss was hard for him. He was tormented by thoughts of the sweet-natured bitch cowering, subjected to the whims of an unkind owner, or succumbing to malnutrition. Of course, there was a chance the new owner was thoughtful, attentive, nurturing, but he had no reason to expect such a happy outcome. In his work, he saw shockingly few people who were fit for their dogs. Walking Sir Henry and the poodle up Cherry Hill, he remembered the Weimaraner, and a pang of grief and regret glanced through him. It was almost 3 years ago. Where was the good creature now? He had looked up Senegal on the internet after she was taken. Senegal is a mainly low-lying country with a semi-desert area to the north. He'd never been to Africa, and in his mind, the Weimaraner lived alternately in the squalor of dusty famine, scrabbling for scraps of food among fly-eyed, hungry children, or the cool white majesty of minarets. There were obdurate camels and palm trees near the Weimaraner, or there were UN cargo planes dropping crates of rice. In less colorful moments, he was quietly certain the Weimaraner was dead. The incident had taught him a valuable lesson, one he firmly believed he should have learned earlier. In the client selection process, people must be subjected to far greater scrutiny than their dogs. He no longer contracted with unreliable owners. If he had reason to suspect an owner or family was not prepared to keep a dog for its lifetime, he did not take the job. It could be difficult. Sometimes a dog owned by one of these irresponsible persons had powerful appeal, grace, sensitivity, an air of loneliness. But the risk was too great. He made himself walk away from these dogs. Sir Henry emitted one short bark, and he and the poodle stopped and stood, tails wagging, pointing to the left. The dog walker stopped too. There was the violinist, wrapped in blankets, seated under a tree in his wheelchair with his attendant and an oxygen tank. The dog walker was surprised. As far as he knew, the violinist, who was at the end stage of a long cancer, never came out of his penthouse anymore. The place had a large wraparound terrace from which the East River could be seen. There were potted trees and even a small lawn on this terrace where the poodle spent much of its time. "Blackie," said the violinist in his weak, rasping voice, and the dog walker obediently let the two dogs approach. "A surprise," said the dog walker. He was not skilled at small talk. "Figured I should take one last stroll in the park," said the violinist and smiled. "Come here, Blackie." The dog walker handed the poodle's leash to the attendant, and Blackie jumped up into her owner's lap. The old man winced but petted the poodle with a bone-stiff hand. "I need to know what will happen to her," said the violinist, "when I die." The dog walker felt embarrassed. Death was an intimate subject, Yet it was close, and the violinist was quite right to plan for his dog. Difficult, he offered. I wonder if I established a trust. Ample provisions, of course, financially. Would you consider... The dog walker, surprised again, looked to the attendant who was holding the leash. She had a beseeching look on her face, and for a minute he did not know how to take this. Finally, he decided the look meant the violinist would not be able to bear a flat-out refusal. Let me think, he said, stalling. It was not in his code. Think fast, said the violinist, though he was still smiling. I will think about it overnight, said the dog walker. You like Blackie, said the violinist, a quaver in his voice. Right? Don't you like her? The dog walker felt a terrible pity enfold him. Of course I do, he said quickly. She's among my favorites. The violinist, on the brink of tears, bent his head to his dog, petting her softly and rapidly as she patiently withstood the onslaught. His attendant shaded her own eyes and blinked into the distance. I'm very attached to Blackie, the dog walker mumbled on. But the adoption of dogs is against my policy. Please give me till tomorrow. Okay, said the violinist and attempted to smile again. I'll try not to kick the bucket before then. I would take her, explained the attendant apologetically, but I just can't. She handed back the leash and Blackie jumped off the lap. We'll see you back at the apartment, called the attendant after him. They had more than half an hour left on the circuit. As the dogs trotted in front of him, he saw Sir Henry turn back to the violinist, checking up on him. If he accepted the dog, in a clear violation of established protocol, would his principles erode? Would he end up an eccentric with an apartment full of abandoned pets? By preferring dogs to humans, he put himself at risk. Myopia on the part of his fellow citizens, of course, since dogs were clearly their moral superiors. Still, he did not wish to be stigmatized. As they neared the 72nd Street entrance, he saw children approaching, delighted. Children were a matter of policy also. He allowed only quiet ones to touch his charges, and he preferred the females. Males made sudden movements, capered foolishly, and often taunted. He stopped now, for these were two melancholy slips of girls with round eyes. May I pet him, please? Asked one of them and suspended a hand in the air over Sir Henry's head. Sir Henry welcomed it. Girls reminded him of the entertainer's daughters, the dog walker thought. Two blonde girls who had caressed him constantly when he was only 3 months old, but now seemed unaware of his existence. Himself, he was preoccupied. This was a critical decision. His mind wandered as the girls leaned down. He gazed in their direction, but he did not see them clearly, bent forms with sunlight on wavy hair. If he owned the poodle himself, he could walk the dogs like this every day, the Dachshund and Blackie. Sir Henry was most contented in the poodle's presence. You get away, said a woman harshly to the girls. She wore tight leather pants and held a phone to her ear. They could bite. They're dirty. They're cleaner than you are, said the dog walker softly. And they never bite nice little girls, only mean old witches. Right now, snapped the woman. Thanks, mister, said the elder girl and looked with longing at Sir Henry as the woman tugged at her arm. He was often grateful that dogs had little use for language. Still, They understood tone. The leather pants woman had slightly offended them, he suspected. A telltale lowering of their heads as they made for the gate. Dogs had an ear for the meaning in voice. Oh, my God, said a fat man in front of them on the path, pointing and laughed. It's David Hasselhoff. He turned to see the entertainer advancing, talking into his telephone and wearing what appeared to be gaudy jogging attire, a jacket with purple details that matched the purple pants. No doubt he was on his way home from the gym. Never before had the dog walker run into two owners on a single walk. Yeah, yeah, said David Hasselhoff on the phone. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. As he passed them, he winked at the dog walker, then swooped down, not stopping, to chuck Sir Henry on the chin. Hey there, little buddy. The dog walker watched his back receding, ogled by various passers-by. With his free hand, the entertainer saluted them jauntily. The Hoff, said one, smirking. They love him in Germany, said another. The dog walker recalled hearing people on the sidewalk discuss the violinist also. He did a recording for Deutsche Grammophon, the Tchaikovsky Concerto in D, that actually broke my heart. It was rare that he considered the lives of owners beyond their animals. To him, they were dog neglectors, most of all. And yet, where would he be without this neglect? The violinist, of course, could not be blamed in the least. He had insisted on walking Blackie himself when he was submitting to a barrage of chemotherapy that would have felled lesser men. The dog walker respected the violinist, though it was unpleasant to see him in his wretchedness. A dog in his state would have been euthanized long ago. In fact, that was how he had met the violinist. The violinist had not gone through the usual channels. The dog walker had come upon him, struggling to keep up with Blackie on a path near Turtle Pond. Two kids on skateboards had almost run them over, and the old man began to tremble violently. His bones were like porcelain. Worse, one of the kids called Blackie a faggot dog as he swooped away on his board. At that time, the poodle had sported an unfortunate continental clip with hip rosettes. Later, the dog walker had persuaded the violinist to switch to a basic lamb. But the skateboarder had infuriated him. Not the words, but what was behind them. Malice directed at the dog. A senseless meanness of spirit. The poodle had never done anything to hurt the kid. He had guided the frail old man to a ledge where he could sit. And from then on, the poodle was one of his charges. He imagined telling the violinist he could not take Blackie. In his mind, he went over the conversation as he stood with the dogs waiting for a walk signal. I'm sorry, he would say, but if I took in all the dogs, even all the dogs I like best, I would be a pet shelter, not a dog walker. The violinist would gaze at him sadly with his watery blue eyes. In his youth, the attendant had said once, the violinist had been quite handsome. And she showed him a black and white photograph. The violinist survived a death camp. Stalin. Now his skin was like paper. His teeth yellow. Can't you make an exception? The violinist might ask. I would like nothing more than to take Blackie in, he could say. But all I can do is help find a new family for her. Allow me to do that, at least. What bothered him was that the violinist had been so good to his dog. Such goodness should be rewarded. If he did not take the poodle, chances were he would never see her again, once the violinist was out of the picture. The poodle would live out the rest of her days with someone who did not care for her as the violinist had. Blackie would be brokenhearted. and Sir Henry would be bereft. Of course, even he, the dog walker, could not promise to bestow upon the poodle the violinist's brand of solitary, desperate cherishing. But with him, at least, the poodle would be assured of a dignified life, a steady stream of affection. At his feet, the poodle looked up at him. "I should be talking to you about this," said the dog walker. "It's not right, isn't it? You don't have a say in the matter at all." No, she did not. Dogs were the martyrs of the human race. The light turned, and the three of them stepped into the crosswalk, forward. The brightness of the day was upon them. He was lucky, he thought, with a sudden soar of hope. Here he was with his two favorite dogs, walking them at a perfect pace for all three. Neatly, they jumped up onto the curb. They did not pull him, and he did not pull them. Could you go forward forever with your dogs at your side? What if he just kept going? Across the city, over the bridge, walking perfectly until darkness fell over the country. Sometimes he wished he could gather all the dogs he loved most and walk off the end of the world with them. When a dog was put to sleep, its chin simply dropped softly onto its paws. It looked up at you with the same trusting eyes it had fixed on you since it was very young. At the violinist's building, he nodded at the doorman. There was a noisy crowd in the elevator, a birthday party of children with conical hats and clownish face paint. He let them cluster and hug the dogs. The dogs licked them. The attendant opened the penthouse door for him. "You beat me here," he told her. Usually he did not attempt these minor exchanges, but he was nervous and needed to fill the space. "Poor Blackie," she said, as she unclipped the leash and hung it. She knelt down and leaned her face against the dog's curly flank. "My husband's allergic to dogs. It's really bad. I mean, he breaks out in rashes, he gets asthma attacks, and nothing helps. Otherwise, I feel so bad I can't keep Blackie in the family." The dog walker stared at her, a realization dawning. It was almost 2 years now that he had worked for them, and it had never occurred to him that she was the violinist's daughter. He had assumed she was paid for her services. "What's wrong?" asked the daughter. "Is something the matter?" "Oh, no," he said, and shook his head. "Nothing. I'm going to sleep on it." This time, the elevator was empty. It had mirrors on every wall, and he watched the long line of reflections as they descended, he and Sir Henry. In the mirror, he saw infinite dogs lie down.
John Lithgow read Lydia Millett's Sir Henry. Shorts literary commentator Hannah Tinty talked with Millett about this sweet story and her writing.
So, Lydia, we've just heard your story, Sir Henry, read by the incomparable John Lithgow. Now, why a Dachshund? You know, they're such silly little creatures, but you give Sir Henry so much dignity and poise. Was that hard to pull off on the page?
Well, I think that Dachshunds speak for themselves. They have that dignitas, yeah.
And why do you think you titled the story Sir Henry?
Because it's so perfect. It's such a pompous name for a noble and proud little dog. I love when people give their animals pompous, absurd names.
Can you talk a little bit about where this story came from? How did it begin?
You know, I think with just a general dog fascination. I just am sort of a dog worshiper, as so many of us are. And I wanted to write a story about someone simply devoted to dogs.
So Sir Henry is part of your collection, Love and Infant Monkeys, and all of the stories in that collection involve animals and involve celebrity. What is it about celebrity that draws you as a theme to explore in your writing?
It's the sort of form of godhood that we embrace in our time, for better or worse, probably for worse.
And the celebrity who makes an appearance in Sir Henry is David Hasselhoff.
The Hoff.
The Hoff. I was so excited when I first heard this story because I was sort of secretly fascinated with him just as a person. Did he in fact own a dachshund, or is that made up?
He did, I believe, own the dogs that are mentioned in the story. And I like him because he's one of the rare cheesy celebrities who involves himself in this sort of, you know, mockery of his own image.
So the other element besides celebrities that we're dealing with is animals in your work. Are animals always a theme, and why are you so drawn to them?
I think that animals are everywhere in our language and our culture, and we don't ever really get away from them. Sometimes they're only placeholders for us, and other times they're resonant symbols of things, and they are such a part of our metaphor and the way we see the world that I don't think we can avoid them at all, and I don't think we want to.
So the final moment in this story, him seeing this reflection of all these dogs lying down, really for me tied together this idea of exiting life.
Well, for me, that moment in the elevator when the dog is reflected many, many times, it was more sort of evocative, as I wrote it anyway, of the dog army, you know, of the army of loyal creatures that flanks us sort of in our daily life, if we're lucky.
Lydia Millett, thanks so much for joining us from Arizona Public Media. It's been a pleasure having you on Selected Shorts.
And it was lovely to be here.
I'm Parker Posey. After a brief break, Love and 140 Characters. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide. From PRI, Public Radio International. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at Zabars.com/shorts. Welcome back to Selected Shorts. I'm Parker Posey. For more information about the stories you're hearing, the readers who are reading them, or about the Selected Shorts writing contest, you can go to SelectedShorts.org or WNYC.org/shorts. And please write and tell us what you think of today's program. We're listening to stories published online by Electric Literature, so it's fitting that our second piece is Rick Moody's Some Contemporary Characters, about an electronic courtship. The characters meet in a chat room, and the rest of their love story is told in tweets. Really. Speaking of contemporary characters, we got Aya Cash and Mike Birbiglia to perform it. Here they are.
Saw him on OkCupid, agreed to meet. In his bio, he said he had a different conception of time. And guess what? He didn't show.
I waited for her 3 days, on and off. They were the wrong 3 days. Went back a week later to that coffee shop of longing.
Bunch more online dates, all candidates underemployed with big plans. One guy worked in a sewage treatment. One guy played sax on the IRT.
The waitress at the establishment used the word honey repeatedly. Each time it was a kindness that in that lonely urban setting.
No lie, I walk by the place where I'm supposed to meet that man. 2 weeks later, he's sitting there reading a book.
Certain questions relating to human conduct require earnest reflection. The rest of the world is absent for a time. How to explain?
A man more than twice your age who's always late. Rule him out right away? Or at least let him attempt to explain himself.
I said, old enough to remember that feminine beauty is nowhere apparent in a point of purchase glossy containing the word cellulite.
I said, young enough to assert a right to text an account, warts and all, from the diner bathroom in case you're a serial rapist.
Willing to play along, if playing along involves a certain idea of language, because we are how we use the tongue now.
The thinning hair, an extra 15 pounds, sure, but I could tell that from the photo online. He wasn't a total schlump.
a jeans with skirt over them type, sort of busty with three different hair colors, none of them found in nature.
I think he wore an earring at some point. You could see the little divot in his earlobe. How long ago and why?
If she had an act to die for, what did that mean with regard to gender politics, and was I willing to die for an act to die for?
What did he actually do? Did he actually do anything? Is it only me who stumbles on these guys whose occupation is daydreamer?
Proposed another sit-down 4 days hence, then drove to Vermont to have my colon cleansed by a harpy with dreadlocks.
I said yes to the date, then hooked up with a coworker, B/C, I could. For the record, colon, the dude with the last shift at Carmen Street Bar.
Next, I suggested a film by Tarkovsky because I felt that if she could sit through it, there might be hope. Instead, the film caused typing.
Dullest movie I have ever seen, colon. Made confessional poetry and folk music night at Student Union sound like big fun. That's how dull.
The suppression of the semicolon, the inability to avoid the use of like semicolon, the over-reliance on the simple sentence, m-dash, ills of the age.
Why agree to a third date? Question mark. Because I already had plenty of people to go with me when I needed eyebrow piercing.
Sooner or later, love is about death, no matter the lover. Desire coughs up the rank fumes of death, and so I propose bowling.
He said, the shoes are sublime. The shoes recall a semiotics of freight train hopping, and yes, the pins connect us to American folklore.
She said, the shoes are funky, and they make me want to dance on one of those light-up dance floor video game things. Give me a 10.
He said, I'd say you were the worst bowler ever, but that would be a dialectical style analysis. And, well, Hegel is so 80s.
She said, if I bowl a strike now, you have to tell me if you're impotent or if you take Viagra or have benign enlarged prostate. End quote.
Maybe he's a life coach, and it'd be just my luck since everyone says I make dumb decisions about things, but I can bowl.
An ungodly strike, an indisputable strike, one pin teetering at the rightmost margin like chastity itself toppling with a dramatic sigh.
Not that anyone's keeping track, but now comes the part when the rules of engagement permit a discussion of human sexuality.
I determined not to gab, and thereby I would be young again by instead using my lips for what lips are designed for, which is not gabbing.
Kissing a guy with gray hair on the street in front of a pizzeria by a bowling alley and shoving my tongue way in, inadvisable, question mark?
Contraindicated, against the code, breaking most conceivable taboos, pedophiliac, bringing waves of guilt. Still, she was ardent.
That was it. Nothing else. And people kiss every day, and the only difference nowadays is that people try to text while kissing.
Her eyes drifted off. I could see her preparing something witty. I can't... keyboard... cause my young... is in her mouth. End quote.
Actually, I did text on the way home, and mainly because I knew my roommate was going to get up in my face. Did he kiss old?
Up around 4 a.m., sorting and recycling back issues of The Nation, a bit more age-appropriate than smooching some barmaid?
He called me because, he said, phoning after a date was required. Landlines. So Tracy and Hepburn. I thought, letting me down easy?
She IM'd me on FB to tell me that her mother had summoned her home for the weekend. She had to go. I thought, medicate her own age.
My mother is 2 years older than he is. Same age, practically. She's already telling me which jewelry is mine when she dies.
Note to self at dawn. S. Spielrein recognized the destructive essence of longing, an idea she passed on, like an STD, to Freud and Jung.
He's assuming that I get all my information from the iPhone or from the interwebs, but I also get my info from bar patrons.
Enough. Enough blather. Enough neurotic vacillation. Enough middle-aged hand-wringing. For whatever reason, she seems to like you. Enough!
Coney Island was open one more weekend, and it was getting cooler, and I had this halter top I really liked. Cream-colored.
I'd never been to Coney Island because I dislike crowds, though I had been writing notes about the Russian mob. Existentialism thereof.
On the train, he told me that his dad, who disliked him and called him ne'er-do-well, left him enough money to survive precariously.
On the train, she indicated that she'd been assaulted by a friend of her older brother when in her middle teens. Details murky and sad.
On the train, he said that his partner of decades, estranged, worked with deaf kids. He saw the loss of her as a great, enduring f-up, end quote.
On the train, she coiled her necklace, some trinket from St. Mark's Place, around her fingers like a proposition she couldn't resolve.
On the train, he said that he hadn't slept with anyone for years, says his one successful relationship has been with solitariness itself.
On the train, she asked what I like to do with my body, and I winced because there was nothing at all that I liked to do with it.
On the train, I asked what he liked to do with his body, and he answered that he wasn't certain. How could he be that he inhabited his body?
On the train, she hooked a thumb in her jeans and looked away. One sandal and then the other traversed the summit of a knee. I watched.
On the train, I tried to flirt, who knows why, because what did I think I wanted? I don't know. Sometimes you just do things.
On the train, she could not flirt much because there was no phone service. And as a result, her affect was much constrained.
On the train, I said that the sand was warm at Coney and there were hypodermic needles, and if you lay down, you could see stars.
On the train, I said that I had lower back pain and needed a lot of support under my knees. In fact, I needed support generally.
On the train, I looked at his gray pullover, his thrift store suit pants, and his whitish hair. This man will be my lover, and then, after that...
On the train, when the riders thinned out, she circled around the metal pole, mocking and engaging the pole dance.
On the train, when everyone got off, I let him know that I knew what was expected, which was the idea of a young woman.
On the train, I asked her why she did these things. Didn't she have any better way of meeting people, if people was what she was after?
On the train, I said, why were you on OKCupid in the first place, trolling for co-eds, if you're against the way people have fun now?
Into an awkwardness of human relations, mercy can sometimes felicitously intrude, or, contrawise, we came to the end of the line.
You can see the cyclone from just about anywhere, and my heart thundered at the screams as we ambled off the train.
You've got to be kidding, said I. I am no longer young. I'm no longer at the point where I can remember my youth. And I'm panicky.
He said spinning things made him puke, and roller coasters reminded him of military service, even though he'd never served.
She said that we were going on the roller coaster no matter what, even when I observed that the freak show was rumored to be of high caliber.
What's a roller coaster but a spot where you make out with someone you just mashed yourself against? Is there another purpose?
Entire phenomenon is really about the first great plummet, because every hill after the first is slightly less persuasive.
You have to be willing to do the first hill and to feel the wooden beams of the frame all shuddery beneath you. The rest is gravy.
A price break is offered the second time around, which is the way life is. You pay to be nauseated, then you get a volume discount on more.
We rode three times, and by the third time, the scary parts got all routine, and he was green, so we went to play skee-ball.
Coney Island is a demolition site, a future overdevelopment shrine, and the only thing that salves the wound is the ubiquity of skee-ball.
Roll this old wooden ball up a ramp and try to get it in this ball-sized hole. Then you get some tickets, which are worth nada.
The tickets are actual tickets because they say ticket on them. If you win 10,000, you can redeem those for a Chinese squirt gun.
I'm good at bowling. I am good at skee ball. And so I won a stuffed rabbit, and we took the rabbit and walked out to the boardwalk.
Out there, the same Atlantic Ocean that laps the Outer Banks and pools in Casco Bay, it shimmers in the moon glow unused.
Every beachfront should have a boardwalk. Every boardwalk should have orthodox couples. Always there should be gang activity.
I said I was writing about the Russian mob and Dostoevsky for contemporary psychoanalysis. I wasn't trying to boast, just talking.
He said he'd like it if we went to have dinner in Brighton Beach because the amusement park was just, quote, too adolescent.
She said I needed to take my, quote, inner adolescent out and show him a really, 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 really nasty time.
And then we were on the beach, pretty ugly beach with all the trash and everything, but next to the Atlantic in twilight.
I come from a landlocked state, PA, and I live part-time in a landlocked state, VT. And so I'm awed by an oceanic expanse.
I don't want to say that something happened on the beach that wouldn't have happened catalytic. It should have happened on the cyclone.
I don't want to say that something happened on the beach, that the ocean was somehow responsible, but she did put away her iPhone.
I was supposed to text or email my friend Ariel every 20 minutes, or it meant he was hacking me to pieces and eating me.
Putting the phone in her pocket was somehow the most revealing thing, like when myopics put their glasses on a bedside table.
There was this light from the boardwalk, sound of the ocean, some Latino troublemakers cackling nearby, and we fell into each other's arms.
In the sand. I can't even stand up most days, what with the bad back, but I fell into the sand, and oh, her arms.
We twisted around some way, so I was on top for a while. He couldn't crush me. I could feel his complications in the dim light.
She was like some sprite, and there was that incredible feeling known to all persons when your cares become insubstantial.
He tasted like Listerine, Mylanta, roast beef, mescaline salad, decaf from one of those old coffee pots from a tag sale, saltwater taffy.
She tasted like chai latte, light beer, nicotine gum, Tic Tacs, grapefruit, cider vinegar, chocolate chip cookies, and the middle class.
He kept trying to say something, but then he couldn't say it. He couldn't say anything. I thought this was amusing.
I think low light helps. A distracting milieu. Tens of hundreds of tourists. Calliope, roller coasters, the moon.
It'd be interesting to see how many languages world over offer some version of the phrase, get a hotel room.
They say, get a hotel room, in Spanish. They can say it in Russian, and they can say it in black vernacular dialect, too.
I like saying, quote, suck my d*** end quote, to any asshole who gets on my nerves, but when you're lying in the sand embracing someone, you just don't bother.
At some point, there were limitations, which were the limitations of conscience and propriety in a public space, no matter how honky-tonk.
You always think that love or sex or whatever are like totally liberated or totally liberating, but there are things you just don't do.
Desaad's only limit was his imagination, you know, but he was in a prison cell when he scribbled down his provocations.
There were a few hotels there, I guess, but we'd have to pay up, and he had no credit cards because he didn't believe in usury.
There are certain hygiene regimens, scalp-related, that I really don't like to do without unless it's absolutely unavoidable.
My parents' names are all over my one Amex, and I didn't want him to see that, and then I realized I didn't have any extra underwear.
So we found ourselves walking back toward the train, upbeat, at least till we realized we'd misplaced the rabbit.
On the train, I thought, Some feelings you only realize later how important they are. Do you know where your toy rabbit is?
On the train, I asked myself, am I ready to step out from the wings onto the stage of romantic activity? Did I somehow slay the rabbit?
On the train, he got even shyer, though I just felt him up against me. I felt his heartbeat and some other parts of him, too.
On the train, she knew what I knew, that I was a retiring person trying not to be, and I was embarrassed in her knowing.
On the train, it started to feel hopeless and awkward, where on the way it had been hopeful, and there'd been an adrenaline of possibility.
On the train, running out of things to say, I figured I'd discuss politics. Must have been desperate, as this is such a bad topic.
On the train, he brought up politics, which to him probably meant like Al Gore or something. I was 13 when Al Gore ran.
On the train, I stammered about campaign financing being the third rail of the American political establishment, and she said, huh?
On the train, I told him that I was pierced, I was tattooed, I was tribal, and loved whatever way I wanted to, and that was my revolution.
On the train, I said, you don't understand. Politics isn't the kind of thing you can just ignore, even if voting is a big buzzkill. And
on the train, I said, the other thing you're overlooking, if you don't mind me saying, is tech stuff, which is, like, so political.
On the train, I said, there's a reason that I have failed at all of this sort of thing for years, and I don't want to have to.
On the train, I said, quote, doesn't it occur to you to give a person a chance? Question mark. Does it occur to you that a person could be different?
On the train.
Question mark. On the exclamation point. On the exclamation point.
On the train, I said, I can tell you are going to use multiple exclamation points when you write this down. And while I admire excess in...
On the train, I said, this is really stupid. We were having a nice time, and now it's all... I really think it's you.
Of course you think it's me, I said. Because when does someone your age take responsibility for her...
You were just waiting to condescend, I said, on the train, and I got up and moved to the other side of the car.
On the train, I thought, I just held this woman, this china vase, this Wolverine, and now I'm no better than the vagrant in the two-seater.
There is a point where you can start repairing all the awful shit you said, but then you kind of dig yourself in and say more awful shit.
I was a social worker at a halfway house back when, and I used to say to clients, when you're becoming angry, you're becoming reverent.
Sometimes I think that when I'm flipping off some asshole, hating him, belittling him, maybe I'm honoring him too.
What if I'm just not in a place anymore when I can go through with it? What if the used-by date is used and bygone?
On the train, I said, I figure you're trying to be nice and you just don't know how because all you really know about me is my bio.
She was rather vehement about my non-awareness of her unique properties from across the car, and I was nodding in agreement.
All this had happened, and we had, like, I don't know, 8 stops or something? I just had to sit there with him staring at me.
We fitted in the whole of a May to December romance from unwarranted optimism to contempt between Surf Ave and Union Square.
I couldn't believe he was willing to write the whole thing off so easy. And now he was going back to his hovel to pick his scabs.
I couldn't believe she wasn't mature enough to realize that this is what happens when you're involved with other people. Roller coastering.
I couldn't believe I rode the train all the way to Coney Island and back with this geezer just because he could quote from philosophers.
We got off the train together, and that was a heavy labor, another Saturday night in which I was to lay myself down beside insomnia.
We got out, climbed the stairs. He was going south, I was going east. We were alike, both guilty of thinking more than we were admitting.
All I could formulate was the perception that I hadn't really kissed anyone like that in so long. Did I not deserve it just a little?
He said, we could just start the conversation over as though we haven't met. You could even play my part. It's a small effort.
But then we were kissing goodnight, and I didn't know why, except that this is the custom, like Judas summoning the Roman guard.
I kissed him goodnight because I was kissing goodbye to all those old guys and their nostalgia and their shaky confidence and felt-tip pens.
I'll call you, I said, which meant, I think, that I devoutly wished to call, but that something was likely to prevent me.
I'll call you, he said, which meant, I guess, that he wouldn't call at all, but that he thought he should say something.
9th Street it was when she turned east toward the park and I could see her receding, an actual person receding.
No one would have thought I ever knew him, except that maybe I walked his dog for him or something or typed his correspondence.
No one would have ever thought that I knew her except from casual encounters on Craigslist or because I needed help with my affairs.
I watched him head into the crosswalk and get almost run over by a bicyclist, and then I called Ariel and told her I was in one piece.
I watched as some fellow accosted her on the sidewalk for loose change, I suppose. In that moment, I seethed with jealousy.
Ariel said I needed to get right back on the horse, the dead horse. So first thing I did was sign on to OKCupid. Any activity?
I knew she was going to post about it. I decided it wouldn't be the actual mutual assured destruction account unless I posted too.
Started following his status updates because I needed to vet them, you know, but also because I was curious. I mean, they're about me.
I'd already friended her, and I confess I felt sad when reading her posts, though can you really be sad about a bunch of ones and zeros?
Like a week later, I saw him through the window in that coffee shop, looking at his watch, contemplating his different conception of time.
Aya Cash and Mike Birbiglia were the twin tweeters in Rick Moody's account of an electronic New York date, some contemporary characters. Both stories on this show were published digitally by Electric Literature, which also commissions artists to create animations based on a single line in each story. You can see Luca Di Piero's animation for Sir Henry and Adam Thompson's design for some contemporary characters by going to electricliterature.com. I'm Parker Posey. Thanks for joining me for Selected Shorts. Next week, Crossing the Line with Jay McInerney and Miley Malloy. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and was directed by Isaiah Sheffer. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith and our mix engineer is Jim Briggs III. Our guest commentator is Hannah Tinty. Our production intern is Julie Hurd. Our programs presented at the Getty Center in Los Angeles are recorded by Phil Richards. Our theme music is David Peterson's That's the Deal, performed by the Deerdorf Peterson Group. Major support for Selected Shorts has been provided by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2012 by Tom Parada. Additional support has been provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Henry Nias Foundation, the New York Community Trust Program for Performing Arts Groups, Ceilings Foundation, and Warren and Jane Weiss and the Applebaum Foundation. Selected Shorts has also been supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts and with public funds from the New York State Council on the Arts. Selected Shorts is brought to you in part by Zabars.com, delivering New York original toasting bagels, coffee, smoked salmon, babka, and more throughout the 50 states, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands. More information at Zabars.com/shorts. Support for this program comes from this station and public radio international stations nationwide, and from the PRI Program Fund. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.